Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. The first application is a policy kit, and so I guess it's said Paul kit. It doesn't sound right to me, but that's how I say policy. Policy. What's your policy? Okay, so Paul. Paul kit. I guess that's how you say it, but that doesn't sound right. I'm sure other accents say it a lot differently. Anyway, Paul kit-agent. Yeah, that's what it is. So Paul kit, to talk about Paul kit KDE agent, one must first talk about Paul kit. I don't think I've talked about Paul kit before. I imagine it's probably more like in the library section of Slackware, the L software series. So I'm going to just talk about it here. Maybe I'll talk about it again later. I don't know. But Paul kit is it's almost, and this is not what it is. I'm saying it is similar to, you might think of it as sudo for your system. It's not. That's not correct. But let's say that it is for a moment. It's more or less sudo, but not for you. It's for your system. So in as much as a computer can make decisions about permissions, in that sense, that's what Paul kit provides. It provides your system the ability to determine whether or not a certain user or a group of users are allowed to, or is allowed to run to access a certain function of an application. And it can get pretty detailed. And to see that, honestly, there's not a whole lot to witness that from the Paul kit-kde agent. The Paul kit-kde agent has a little desktop file in AutoStart. It's got some licensing files and a systemd service. Not that that's actually being used on this system, but it is there in case you install systemd on your Slackware box. There's a libexec file, so that's kind of like in user lib64, so that's the agent itself, really. Or that's the closest thing to an executable that we'll get. A desktop file in applications. That's interesting. Didn't know about that one, to be honest. And then finally, so does that mean that I could... No. Agent, no. I don't think that's anything. Okay. And then a K notifications configuration file. So that's all that's present in the Paul kit KDE agent. So technically that's all that needs to be said about this. But like I say, I'm going to talk a little bit about what Paul kit is just to contextualize this. And that may mean that I repeat myself later if I've forgotten that I've already talked about Paul kit when we come across Paul kit, probably in the L series. So Paul kit, as I've said, gives permissions to applications, and to get a little bit more insight into that, what you can do is look in user share Paul kit-1, and you'll find that there are two directories there, actions and rules.d. In the rules.d file, there are rules. There are things that describe the different sort of actions that you could take on your system and how much access you have to those things. So for instance, if I look at tin-enable-upower-suspend, see that it's a Paul kit add.add rule, function action subject, if action ID equals upower suspend, action ID equals or hibernate, then subject is in group power. In that case, return Paul kit result yes. That's pretty self-explanatory if you think about what I just said. Like, it's obviously looking at a signal being sent or a call being made to Paul kit, and it is saying, hey, if that call is being made to something with the name org.freedesktop.upower.suspend or org.freedesktop.upower.hibernate, then, and the subject of the call is in the group power, then Yes, it's allowed. Yes, permit that. So that's a rule. There are other kinds of files called actions, and those action files are XML files stored in user share pulkit1 actions, and they're named for their project org. For instance, the first one on my system, org.blueman.policy. So I'm going to actually grep lang equals / quote en in that file and then pipe that through most, and that way I'm just seeing the stuff that I can actually parse with my single language ability. So it says description XML lang equals en. Of course I should have chosen one en. There's actually two ens, en underscore gb, en underscore au. So I have a bunch of doubles here, but that's okay. I guess even simpler. No, that wouldn't. Okay. Anyway, so configure Bluetooth network. That's a description. Configuring network requires privileges. Launch DHCP client. Launching DHCP client requires privileges. Launch PPP daemon. Launching PPP daemon requires privileges. So you kind of get you're getting probably the gist of this file just from that description. These are descriptors of what you might be able to do, interface with the Bluetooth, application, whatever way you're interacting with it. And something is reading from this file and catching when you try to do something with Bluetooth that, for instance, might require escalated privileges. So I guess in a way, it's almost like the inverse of sudo. It's like the system, it's the door upon which sudo might go a-knocking. So for instance, if you're trying to rfkill through set the rfkill state of your Bluetooth transmitter on your laptop, then when you attempt that triggers a pulkit action, and it pulls from this XML file, presents you with a message saying, hey, you can't do that without extra privileges. So if you're not in the right group, you're going to get that error message. If you are in the right group, or if you escalate privileges, whatever the situation might be, then Pulkit would presumably let you in. Now that isn't in this file. This is just, it looks to me like this is these are action IDs. Yeah, so this is action ID org.blueman.network setup, for instance. So if something is making a call to a function with that, with the property org.blueman.network.setup, then these descriptions, these policies are going to be echoed potentially back to you in the event that you're trying to do something that requires more permission than what you have. So that's what Pulkit does. It monitors what you're trying to do with various applications. It looks at who you are, who's making the call, who's attempting to use this application in some specific way. And obviously, through the magic of XML and rule files, you can have a bunch of different methods of interacting with something. You can really get down to really just the barest sort of granularity, the specificity of just trying to turn off the Bluetooth chip, or the I don't know what other things are there here. Too many things in my scroll history to look. But yeah, there's a lot of things that might have, like gparted, for instance. Are you trying to format a disk, or look at backlight helper, charge threshold helper, smart policies, KCMK wallet, that's kind of an important one, set gconf settings, install a new flat pack, and so on and so on. So lots of different things that you could, that an author of an application could potentially restrict based on sort of the risk that they think that policy involves, or that interaction involves. So that's Pulkit. I don't think I have a whole lot more to say. Oh, yes, I do. Really quick. So Pulkit doesn't know what calls are being made to what application magically. Like these properties, org.blueman.network.setup, that sort of thing, those aren't just generated sort of by magic. And the way that those get identified are through the Polkit library itself, which you would include. There's a bunch of header files in user include polkit-1, and we'll see those again later, like I say, in the L series, the library series. We'll see those. We probably won't go through them because they're kind of boring, but they have names like polkit action description, polkit authority, polkit details, polkit error, polkit identity, polkit permission, and so on. Subject, polkit subject. Remember in the one rule, there was that subject ID or user is in group or whatever. Subject is in group. So important little elements there. You include that into your code, and suddenly signals being sent back and forth between your code from user space, they get tagged with little descriptors, and those descriptors can be parsed by Polkit. So that's how it all fits together. The developer uses Polkit headers. When the application is running, the desktop is able to interface, or the user is able to potentially interface with that application. And when they do, they may or may not trigger, well, they do trigger a Polkit review of what is being attempted. Let's talk about PowerDevil. Not PowerDevel, like developer, but devil, like a devil. You know, like goat horns and sign of the beast and all that other good stuff. Devil. So PowerDevil is the system setting panel. It's a KCM module, so we know what those are. KDE configuration module. And the way that you see it is in your system settings, you go to, I think it's probably called power or something, power, energy saving. Of course it would be called energy saving, not power. So if you go to energy saving, then there is energy saving on AC power, on battery, on low battery. So you can set how your computer behaves under different power sources. So this is obviously really, really useful on a laptop, but it's handy everywhere. If you're ever if you're ever sort of, I don't know, watching a video, and so you haven't moved your mouse or you haven't typed or anything because you're just watching a video on your computer for a long time, like a movie. Sometimes in a fresh computer that hasn't been mangled by you yet, its settings often just default to, hey, after, you know, like 10 minutes of inactivity, dim the screen or go to sleep. If you need to change that because you're regularly watching videos that are 12 minutes long, then, or longer, you know, over the 10-minute threshold, for instance, then you might need to change that. And you could go to PowerDevil, or actually what it's sort of labeled, energy saving. Also, there's a subheading of power management, though, so there is that as well. Whatever we're calling it, energy saving is what came up, you know, for me when I typed in power in my system settings. Power goes to energy savings. If I click on that, then I have the different tabs. So you can change the settings there. You could say switch off the screen after 10 minutes, or when power button is pressed, prompt a logout dialog. Don't just shut down. Don't just begin shutting down, or do just start shutting down. You know, whatever you prefer. When you're on battery, when do you want? Those aren't really active for me because I'm not on battery. But those are your options. Those are your kinds of options within PowerDevil. And that, as you can imagine, has a bunch of in the package. There are some libraries, .so files, and there are Polkit policies governing whether or not you can do certain things. So that's kind of a nice little connection to what we were just talking about. And let's see, anything else? No, not really. I mean, I think there's like a desktop file, you know, stuff to help you just launch it from your KDE menu, your K menu. So if you do type in, if you go to your K menu and type in power, then eventually down here at the bottom I have energy saving, and you can go to that and it'll open up system settings straight to that module. PoxML. It's not really PoxML, it's PoXML, but PoxML sounds nerdly. So PoXML is a Git text related tool developed for KDE. That's why it's in the KDE software series. And it is a translation tool for DocBook. Now, if you've listened to me for a very long time, you will know that I'm a huge fan of DocBook. I don't use it half as much as I used to. Just as recently as, I guess, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I was living in DocBook quite happily at work. It was a great little time because I just got to do DocBook all day. It was great. And before that, I'd been doing DocBook for fun, as a user, just personally. These days, I don't get to live in it at work. I get to still use it, of course, personally for fun. But at work, the workflow has changed because I changed departments. So don't get to do as much DocBook anymore. But I love it. It's a great system. And I love it for its explicitness. It is very clear about what elements are what text is what element. There is no question whether a list is a list, whether a sublist, you know, a list embedded in another list is a list embedded in another list. The code is very clear. There are code blocks, and beyond that, it's not just, hey, this text is code. There's a semantic context to things as well. So not only can something be code, but it could be possibly user input, or it could be something appearing on a screen, or it could be a program listing, like code listing, all kinds of different things. So it's a great system because of its verbosity, and that is also its greatest weakness. The DocBook is it's XML. It is a schema of XML, and for that reason, it is very verbose. The tags that it uses are very long. Something, for instance, something as simple as a paragraph. HTML, as you may know, uses left angle bracket P, right angle bracket. That's the tag. In DocBook, that's left angle bracket P-A-R-A, right angle bracket. So same functional tag, a lot longer, four times as long. So that is a reason that a lot of people don't tend to love DocBook. And another reason, I think, I suspect even more of a reason, because, I mean, your IDE is going to fix that for you anyway, right? Whatever you're using to do DocBook, it's going to fill all that stuff in for you, and autocomplete tags and stuff like that. Not a big deal, really. What I suspect is that people don't like the strictness of XML. If your document doesn't build, if it's not correctly structured, then it will not build. It's your job to go in and find the mistake. Why is it not correctly structured? Oh, did I put a paragraph outside of a section without starting a new section? Yeah, I guess that would be a problem. Okay, well, let me move that paragraph into the section, or move the section tag functionally down. So it can be frustrating. It can be really frustrating. And certainly in a coding environment, it can be potentially really bad if you don't do a test build before you push your change to the Git server. You may have just broken the build, if your documentation is being built alongside with the software. Not that I've ever done that before. That was sarcasm. So there is a lot of, I think, really significant use case for DocBook in the real world. And it is kind of falling out of favor, I think, for the more forgiving formats. Ideally ASCII doc, but it doesn't have quite the momentum that Markdown has. So Markdown, you know, whatever. Right, as I say, structure is better than no structure. So whatever form that takes, ultimately structure is good for your documentation, for your code, for your text, because that can be parsed. But focusing on DocBook, that can really be parsed, because there's not just structure. There's context. There's semantics. There's a lot of data that you can parse there. Now, let's say you've written a bunch of documentation and you decide that you want to distribute that documentation to a bunch of people who don't speak English, and you want them to be able to translate the documentation for you. You can do that. You can send them the documents. They can re-implement the document, and that'll theoretically work. But translation can be managed, as we've seen in previous episodes, by a system called GitText, and you can generate translation files that look for strings in documents that are meant to be user-facing, extract those strings, present it to a translator, and then that translator can rewrite the string and send it and save it back to the documentation project as a translation file. They don't have to worry about sort of the structure of the file. They just have to look at the strings and translate what they read. Well, PoXML is a tool chain to make that really simple. Here, I'll show you. So I'm going to open up a sample, a test document. I'll call it test.xml. And I'm going to start with bracket question mark XML space version equals quote 1.0 close quote question mark close angle bracket. Next, I'm going to make this an article. Article is a simple doc book document type. There's article, there's book, I think there's another one. So bracket article space XML ns, that's a XML namespace, equals http://docbook.org/ns for namespace /docbook close quote. And I think that's basically all I need. Version equals 5.0. I guess we could do XML colon lang equals en for English. That way, for translation stuff, I guess that probably is significant. And then I'm going to do an info block. So that's bracket info, close bracket title, close bracket. And I'll call this article docbook document, close title, close info. All right. Every article needs a section, I think. I don't have my docbook in front of me, my docbook guide, the TDG. I don't have it in front of me. It's just about, 2 meters away from me, but that's 2 meters too far. Just right there, back on my bookshelf. I can see it. Okay. So angle bracket section, close angle bracket. I could do like a title of the section, but I'm not going to. I'll just do, actually, maybe I have to. I'm not sure. All right. I don't want to do a title, and I won't explain why, but just trust me. Para, and then hello world, close para, close section, close article. We're done. That's 15 lines. I told you doc book was verbose. It is. It's verbose. I mean, what can you do? But like I say, that's kind of part of the beauty of the system. Okay. So we got a hello world article here in docbook. Now, processing docbook is pretty simple, after a fashion. You have to get docbook XSL sheets. You need those to process it. And then you can use XSLT proc. There are lots of other ways to process docbook. I feel like we even covered a couple in the past. There were some tools going from docbook, I think, and in some, I think it might have been like Linux utils or something. But anyway, XSLT proc is the one that I typically sort of default to, and the thing that you need to give it is an XSL style sheet, and then the XML you want to transform. That's what XSLT proc is. It's an XML transform tool. So XSLT proc, and then I just copied my docbook folder, my docbook style sheets, to this test directory for just to keep it simple. So that's docbook-xsl-version/html/docbook.xsl. So this is a docbook XSL in an HTML folder. So I am transforming it into HTML. What am I transforming? Well, test.xml. Hit return and I get output. And it's HTML. It is HTML, head, meta type, blah, 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 close head, open body, div class, where's the title? Somewhere in there, there's a title. There it is, div class title page, H2. Why did I give it a H2? I would have made that an H1 personally. So I don't care for that. Anyway, there's a document here, and it's an HTML rather than XML, and of course I wrote that document in XML. So that's sort of the advantage of having things in XML. You can use other tools to transform them, to process them. Of course, you can do the same thing with lots of other formats. You can use Pandoc for practically everything, for instance. Not a big deal, but it's a thing, and it's not that complex. Okay, great. There's a proof of concept, not a problem. How do we get that document, docbook document, hello world, how do we get that translated into the hands of our translators so that they can take the strings and translate them for us? Well, the way that we could do that is generate a PO file, or I think it might be a POT file, technically. I kind of forget, but you can do info get text, And the third section in there is PO files, the format of PO files. And so there's all the information you need. A PO file is made up of many entries, each entry holding the relation between an original untranslated string and its corresponding translation. It gives samples. It's a really well-written document. It's got examples. It kind of tells you how to generate it and so on. But you don't have to do any of that. There's a tool in this tool chain called XML2PO, XML2PO, and I think I'll just do a dash dash help because I don't remember what it wants from me. So it just wants XML2PO and then the name of the document that I want to sort of transform into a PO. So that's test.xml in this case. Oh, that did not work. How about, there we go, XML2POT, that's what it is. So XML2POT space test XML dumps out a bunch of text into your terminal. It looks like a PO file to me. So I'm going to rerun that, but I'm going to redirect the output to, let's do esperanto.pot. Now I'm going to open up esperanto.pot. It asks for me to give it some descriptive title, so I could call it test document Esperanto translation, the author, CLAT2, email address, CLAT2@hackerpublicradio.org, year 2023. And then it starts with some, it looks like declarative text about like the package version and the PO revision date, the last translator, the language team, bunch of kind of like KDE, I shouldn't say KDE specific, because it's not all KDE specific, but it's kind of leaning in that direction, like the language team, KDE-IL-I18N-DOC, and so on. So the part that I want to focus on right now is the PO part. So the first line, #:title. Well, wait a minute now, title, that's an XML tag for DocBook. And sure enough, that's exactly what it's talking about. Now it tells you the line number, and then it gives you the message ID, which is DocBook document. You remember that. That was the title I gave my little sample document, my article. So now I've got a message string, MSGSTR, message string, and it's blank, it's empty, just quote, quote. That's the part it wants me as the translator to fill in. So I'm gonna put docbook, which I wouldn't want to translate a noun like that. And I guess in a lot of XML, a lot of docbook, you would probably find that was tagged as like product name or literal, some tag to tell the translator, hey, do not try to translate this. This needs to be exactly as I typed it. I didn't think of that when I was typing my test document, but in real life, that's what you would do. You would use, and you would want to check with your team to see what tag they were using to indicate that to their translator team. It would probably be something like, yeah, product name. I think that's a general purpose DocBook tag. That's what we used back at a former job. Product name meant do not translate. But you can always also just use literal, or is it literal string? I don't know. One of those two. Obviously, like I say, I don't use DocBook at work anymore. So my coordination efforts are a little bit rusty. I don't have to coordinate with myself. I just do whatever I want to do. Tag, para, that was on line 12. Message ID is hello world. Message, MSGSTR, message string, is again empty, quote, quote. So I guess I'll type in saluton mondo. I'll save it, I'll close it. And now we've got a translated version of the XML in a translated file. What good is that to us? Well, possibly nothing, but then again, maybe it's something that we can use in this tool chain, and that is, of course, what we can do. So PO2XML, again, I'm going to use help here because I don't remember the orders. Yeah, so PO2XML wants the name of my XML file, which is test.xml, and then the translated-PO. So that would be esperanto.pot. Hit return. Again, it just spits it out into the terminal, so you'd really want to redirect it in real life. You've got XML version, article. So this is the DocBook stuff again. Info, title, documento, DocBook. close title, close info, section para, saluton mondo, close para, close section, close article. So it's the doc book document, almost exactly. I mean, the spacing and the line breaks are a little bit different, a little bit ugly, to be honest. It's got like the closing angle bracket after title on the next line. I've seen this before in real life, and I guess this is why. Either way, I mean, it doesn't matter, right? XML doesn't care. As long as those characters are there, it's happy. So this is the document, this is the doc book document that I typed with all the tags that I was using, but with different text, like translated text. How cool is that? And how simple is it? How simple is it that you literally have a tool to go from your XML to POT, and then from the work, from PO to XML, bang, bang, you're in, you're out, it's done, you've got the translation. So beautiful, so cool. I mean, that is really nice. And I realize it's probably not that big of a deal. Looking at it, it's probably some ridiculously simple sed script or something. No, it is not. It is an ELF binary. Okay. But still, you know, I mean, like, you could imagine doing that with, yep, both of them are ELF binaries. You can imagine doing that with, you know, sed or awk or something. Like, it can't be that hard, especially with XML. Because, I mean, XML is so formal, right? It has, especially not only XML, it's docbook. So it's a defined schema. So you know exactly a list, you have a list of all the valid tags. Like, you know exactly the things you're looking to ignore, and you can extract strings. You know, you can imagine how you could hack that together. But this exists, it is on the system, and it is really, really nice. So if by some weird chance you are writing in DocBook, congratulations, we should talk. And then also, if you're writing a docbook and need translations done, this is the easy way to do that. I mean, as you see, there's nothing you need to sort of set up. Like, this is done. Like, you can, when you export, before you send your files to your Git server or whatever, run an XML to pot and put that in a translation folder, and people can go there and use that PO file to create localized versions of your document. And all they have to do is submit one file back to you, their language.po, or however many files there are. Submit those to you, and now you've got a translation. It's very, very cool. Highly, highly excited. It's very cool, and I'm quite excited to have discovered this. I think I've probably used either this or something like it before without really knowing it. Well, not personally used, but I believe I've been in a workflow where this kind of thing was being used. And this does really make it nice. There are two other files here included. There's split2PO and swap.PO. I don't know what those do. I bet they're really, really useful. I mean, I guess I could, you know, swap.PO. Swapo. Swapo reads the given PO file and swaps the MSG ID and MSG string fields for every message. So it's a translation in the opposite direction. I don't know the use case for that. I'm not sure. And then the other one was, what was it? I don't remember what it was. Swap.PO and split2PO. Split2PO creates a PO file from two docbook XML files. Oh, that's very useful. So, oh, that is very nice. But can you go, so if you have two XML and then you put it into one PO file, how do you, oh, you just concatenate the other ones? I don't know. I don't understand quite the processing. Oh, no, it doesn't matter. Yeah, okay. So, yeah, okay, cool. Yeah, neat. Yeah, so split2PO, swap.PO, POT, PO to XML, and XML to POT. Super, super useful tools. Very exciting. I wish I was doing more translation. I mean, I'm not doing any translation, but what a powerful tool set. I think it's time for coffee. I mean, something that cool deserves a reward of coffee. So let's go get some coffee. We'll come back, finish up the episode. Okay, we're back. As promised, I have a cup of coffee. Hopefully you've had the good fortune of getting your own cup of coffee. saw a very cool coffee brewing method the other day using essentially differential pressures where it's basically a mocha pot, I guess, but it was unique because you put the water in one beaker and coffee grounds in another. You connect them through a pipe, and in the one that has the water, that needs to be sealed, you know, airtight sort of. I mean, obviously not the hose connecting the two isn't, but I mean, you know, you want to trap the water otherwise. Boil the water. It sends the water through the hose into the other beaker containing coffee grounds. The hot water mingles with the coffee grounds and therefore brews the coffee. It creates, you know, the coffee. It infuses the water with coffee. Then remove the heat from the one that was boiling, and as it cools, it starts to create a vacuum effect. And it sucks all of that now coffee from the other container back through the hose into the original container again. So you've brewed coffee, or you've infused water with coffee, and then you leave the coffee grounds behind and you just get the coffee back. It was pretty cool. It was really neat. I'd never seen anything quite, well, I have seen something quite like it. I mean, the idea of moving water from one container to another through heat, that part, yes, I completely have seen. But in a stovetop espresso maker, or a mocha pot, as people apparently call them, there's that sort of, there's a filter, you know, there's a grating that kind of prevents the coffee grounds from going, you know, going along with the water. And that pressure and everything creates essentially an espresso, a stovetop espresso. But with this method, this differential pressure method, that's not what's happening. You know, you're brewing coffee. I don't know what that method would be called. It's, I don't know, hot water and coffee grounds, but then getting it back into the other container by removing the heat. And I don't know how long it took to sort of cool down and create that vacuum effect. I'm not sure how long that takes, but it's either way, it was a very cool thing to see. Very, very sciencey sort of way of making coffee, I thought. Anyway, let's talk about the next thing on this list, which is Print Manager. Now, for the longest time, I did not have a printer in my life, but a couple of years ago, someone was throwing out a laser jet printer HP thing, and I mean, they were literally throwing it away. So I thought, okay, I'll take that. So I took it, brought it home, plugged it into the Linux, of course. Yeah, it just worked. And it's a horrible printer. I mean, it's a great printer. It's a laser, like, a laser jet or whatever. So it's a lot better than like the ink jets and stuff that, you know, you'd have a cartridge for, and the cartridge would either dry up or get used up, you know, 3 months after you bought the thing, and then you'd have to buy another cartridge, and surprise, surprise, the cartridge is as much, literally as much or more as the printer in the first place. So this has not been that experience. This thing has been just printing and printing and printing. I don't know how long the person must have had it for ages before me. Maybe they just put a new toner in or something, because it just keeps printing. I've never renewed the toner yet. I don't know how. It is a little bit dirty though. It prints. It's a little bit messy, and I'm assuming that's probably a signal that the toner needs replacing, but I just print so rarely and for such casual purposes that I just haven't bothered. Anyway, exciting thing there is that I have a printer, so I can print stuff on the off chance that I need something printed, which sometimes you do. You know, government organizations sometimes want paper, people sometimes want paper. I've got a printer, and so I actually utilize little conveniences like print management systems. And if you look in the system tray of your KDE, of your Plasma desktop, you may see somewhere, you might have to look around for it, and it may not be there if you don't have a printer connected, but if you do have a printer connected and you look around, you may find a little widget for printers. If you click on that, you are now experiencing the Print Manager. That is exactly what the Print Manager is. Now, in my case, I have HP_LaserJet_P 2015_red, which is a name, the underscore red is the name that I gave it, because it is sitting next to a red wall. And So that was kind of like the location of that printer, more or less, in the string. Just on the off chance that I got another HP LaserJet P215, I guess. I don't know, 2015. I don't know why I did that, but that's the name. Next to it, there's a pause printing button, which, I mean, it's not printing now, so it doesn't really matter. But I could pause it. I'm not going to for fear of confusing the printer. I hate printers. It seems that no matter what you do, they always get confused and think that they should be paused, and then you have to go restart the queue and all that other nonsense. So I'm not going to touch it, but there it is. Now, there are a couple of different binaries included with this package. I mean, there is a library called libkcupslib.so, and there's a kcm_printermanager.so. So KCM, we know that, KDE configuration manager, module manager, and a couple of different binaries. So there's configure-printer, KDE add printer, and KDE print queue. Probably can't remember all those. So I'm just going to type in configure-printer. It looks like pm.configure.printer, no printer was specified. Arguments, it wants a printer to be configured. So that's probably looking for literally like HP_LaserJet_P2015_red. Yeah, that's correct. And then that brings up a configure printer GUI window. Right now it's under modify printer because that printer did exist. And so it's showing me the description, the location, the connection type. This is USB because my work, my desktop serves as the essentially as the print server. If my workstation's not on, then the printer is not available to anyone else in the house. And then the driver, current HP LaserJet P2015 series, PCL3, HP Cups 3.20.5. That's the driver that it's using right now. There's printer options. Media size is A4 by default. What tray it prints out of, the output mode, and so on. Banners and policies, and all that stuff. I'm going to hit cancel because I don't actually want to change that. So that's a little GUI configurator, which is quite nice. And then you've got KDE add printer and KDE print queue. All of this stuff is also pretty much in, if you type in print, then you get a, what is it, printer settings? Yeah, printer settings. But is this the KDE one? I don't think it is. No, that's not the, no, that's the wrong one. Sorry. Printers. That's what it's called. Printers. There we go. Okay, printers. That opens up the system settings to the printer section. And then you can click add printer. You can go into configuring that printer specifically, which is exactly, that's the configure-printer GUI that we saw earlier. So yeah, all of this stuff is available from the system settings because, again, KCM printer module. And it's pretty simple, really. Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. I have had nothing but great experiences with printers on Linux. I say nothing but great experiences, meaning I've had good experiences with printers on Linux that compares to my good experiences with printers on other systems. So there have been bad experiences. You know, there have been times where it's not as straightforward as it should be to add that printer or whatever. But I mean, in general, if it's, you know, I don't know, 7 out of 10 printers, then when I go to add them to my system, they just get added. Now, I understand I'm in a bubble. I live in a bubble. I live in my little world. You know, I might be going to all the right places. In your life, you might be going to all the wrong places. You might have drawn the unlucky printer card and you just keep getting the bad ones. And my luck might change. Who knows? But in my experience so far, adding printers has been really, really simple on Linux. You just go to System Settings, go to printers, and you add the printer. Now, sometimes there's some confusion about, like, well, what driver to use? Where is that located? Like, how do I find that? And in, even in those cases where it's kind of like, uh-oh, panic attack, like, what, it's not just adding, then, you know, a quick search online brings me to, like, the PPD file from the vendor, or it brings me to the driver from the vendor, or it brings me to, or it reminds me to install Fumatic or GhostScript or something like that to magically give myself all those other drivers. So I've had really, really I've had a great experience with adding printers to Linux. And I remember that that's not always the case on other systems. Like, I have definitely had experiences setting up printers. I don't know if I've told this story before, but back in my brief university days before I dropped out of university because it's a waste of money, I was a computer repair person basically. I just posted notices in like grocery stores, you know, computer help, call this guy, and people would call me. And 9 times out of 10, it seems like it was to set up a new printer. Maybe 5 times out of 10. No, actually 9 times out of 10. And then 5 times out of 10, there was also a new computer to be set up along with that new printer. That was a big deal. So I've set up a lot of printers. And once I started getting into Unix specifically, I discovered Cups. And then I became like the guy in my local area who could actually get your printer networked. Like, that was a big deal for me. That was a top seller. Like, people would call me specifically because their friend had told them that I'd done something so that their printer just, you could just print from anywhere in the house. And that was a big deal. Like, that was a huge deal. I don't even know that I knew what I was doing. Like, looking back, I'm just like, how did I know how to do all that stuff? But I did it and it worked. So I guess I must have. And I, again, it's probably a lot of dumb luck as well. You know, probably got the right set of printers at sort of the right development time on the right couple of home routers or the right setup, you know, just, I'm sure there was a lot of just kind of like coincidental sort of convergences, but it was good. So I feel like I've done a lot of setting up of printers, and on some operating systems, it's not easy. Like, it really isn't. It's not an easy thing. I know that Windows, I think if memory serves, would very frequently sort of like try to second guess you, try to get it done for you, but then it would always inevitably fail. I remember that being a problem all the time. Like, it would just somehow like identify what you were trying to do, and then it would try to do it for you, and it would fail every single time. And it just used to frustrate people so much. And then, you know, the printers would have a disk with them that would have the driver on it, but it would be like an outdated driver, or it'd be a driver with a bunch of like bloatware included on the CD for some weird reason. It would have its own custom application where you'd have to configure the thing. I mean, it was phenomenal. And then, of course, Mac OS, like, you've got a whole other set of problems because no one was writing drivers for that for ages. Like, literally when Mac OS 10 started, like, there were no printer drivers. It was a huge problem for the print industry. People were outraged. And eventually it got better, and then Apple just bought Cups. They just purchased the solution by employing the developer of Cups. And it works. And it works for Linux just as well. That's the beauty of it. Now, I'm not going to say that printers have seen the light and they've all fixed the problem that is modern printers, because they haven't. They're horrible. They're probably getting worse every day. They try to out-compute the computer. It's horrible. It's a terrible, miserable experience, and I hate home printing. I really do. If I could just get, I mean, I'm almost away from it. Like, I do have a printer, like I said, because I got it out of the trash. But you know, the times that I don't have to print far exceed the times that I do have to print, and it's through things like mobile devices, ebook reader, e-ink notepad, things like that, where you don't have to print. You just send it to a device and then you have it, and it's good enough. So lots of reasons to avoid printers. But if you're doing a printer setup on Linux, especially on Plasma Desktop, just go to Add Printer and add that printer. See what happens. It may well just work. And if not, you might have to fish around a little bit for a PPD. And it's just so nice. Could it be better? Yeah, it could be better. It could totally be better. Like, finding a network printer still is a complex thing. Like, you still have to know where to look for that printer on the network. You have to choose a protocol. Are you going to go IPP? Are you going to go like HTTP or Samba? Or how are you going to get to that printer? That's still not a fun experience. It's still easier to just plug it in through USB. Sharing that printer across your network, that should be easier. That should be more straightforward. You know, there are lots of little things that could be better, but it is for the basics. Like, you go out and buy a printer, add it to Linux. It's a great experience. Many times It's a very good experience. If not more often than at least as often as you having a bad experience. So I would, you know, try to add that printer, see what happens. Don't fiddle around with cups yet. Just go to add printer and see if it connects. And you know, certainly I would connect a printer to USB first, do a test print, make sure that it works, and then go out to the network. You know, then try the fancier setups. But yeah, very, very comfortable, very happy with the state of printing on Linux, or at least as happy as I'm going to be with the state of printing in general. Okay, next up, Prison. I don't know how to interact with this. This is a barcode API. It's a cute thing. It's a cute based API to produce QR code barcodes and dot matrix barcodes, which I assume dot matrix must be the lines that you see like at the grocery store, like on the back of the boxes that you buy or something. I'm assuming that's a dot matrix barcode. So yeah, this is all just built in to Qt apparently, although it's in the KDE package set. So I guess it isn't Qt, it's KDE, but it does say it's a Qt API to produce these things. Now, this is a compiled library, libprisonquickplugin.so, and some header files. I don't know how to use this. I don't know what I would do with it, but there it is. That's what Prison is. It's not a very spectacular ending for this episode, really. Is there a quick win? Pulse Audio Qt. That is not a quick win. Okay, we'll just, actually there are, you know what though? There are just a couple. There's only two more in the P section and then we're on to Q. Well, that's too much to resist. Okay, I guess we have to do it then. So Pulse Audio Qt it's the Plasma Desktop, the KDE project bringing, as far as I know, Pulse Audio to Qt. I mean, it's kind of a big deal unless I'm reading too much into it, but it feels to me like without this, the Qt framework wouldn't be interacting with Pulse Audio. That's what it sounds to me like. And I don't have confirmation on that. I haven't looked it up. I haven't looked into trying to interface with Pulse Audio from just sort of raw Qt. So I could be wrong. But again, sounds like to me like either that's not the case, or this just has, you know, more functionality. Maybe what kind of functionality does this have? Well, it's a bunch of header files, but there are things like card port, client, device, models, module, port, server, sync input, source output, stream restore, and so on. So these are important concepts to Pulse Audio, none of which I can keep straight. I never remember. I think sync is essentially a thing that you are sending sound out of, I think. And then source is a thing that is generating sound. But I believe that the problem in Pulse Audio, or the problem that Pulse Audio terminology is trying to solve, is that when you say, oh, sound is, you know, is this the sound output? Well, what does that mean? Because to some people, a sound output might mean the software that you have pressed a software-based play button. And so now it is generating essentially a stream of audio data that you want to send somewhere. Is that audio output? Well, to the user, no, that's not audio output. That's just the media player. And then there's speakers that is going to interface with their ears. That is the audio output to them. So I think to Pulse Audio, they've chosen to just go with new terminology and call, like, your speakers, the thing that's going to be producing sound waves for your human ears. I believe that's the sync. And then the media player would be the server, or maybe the source, or maybe both. I don't know. No, it'd be the source. Server, I'm sure, is Pulse Audio itself. So anyway, those are all include files within KDE Framework 5. There are some CMake files to help compile all that stuff, and then there's a library, libkf5pulseaudioqt.so. So if you want your application to interact with Pulse Audio, this would be something to look at. And like I say, I don't know, maybe there's some basic, I guess I could even look, just Qt, Qt 5 Pulse Audio. Let's just do a quick search for that and see what happens. Audio overview in Qt Multimedia. So these are the documentation, this is the documentation rather. And I'm gonna just do a find Pulse. I am not seeing Pulse. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I could be wrong. This is an impromptu search happening live in front of you, and I kind of apologize for that, but I mean, not enough to stop and delete this part, I guess. But yeah, I mean, this is interesting because, yeah, so I do see there is a, yep, okay, there are plugins for this. All right, we're good. Q Audio System Plugin class. That is a, Q comes with plugins for Windows, WinMM, and Wasapi, and Linux, Alsa, and Pulse Audio, macOS, iOS, Core Audio, Android, OpenSLES, and QNX. So there are plugins for Qt that send audio to various, let's call them SDKs, and, or I guess you could say that Qt was the SDK. Either way, whatever. There are plugins, so it could happen. I'm going to assume, though, that this KDE framework thing offers better support or maybe easier to interface with support. Like, it may literally work just as well, but maybe it's easier to deal with the KDE framework one or something like that. So, yeah, it's interesting. I guess not quite as essential as I was assuming from it sort of... from its existence, but good to know about, I'm sure. I mean, I'm sure it's got a purpose. Wait a minute, purpose? That's the next package on our list, and it's the last package in the P section of KDE. So after this next episode, we'll start with the Qs. So this is purpose, and it offers actions for a specific purpose. Brilliant. I love it. This framework offers the possibility to create integrated services and actions on any application without having to implement them specifically. Purpose offers the mechanisms to list different alternatives to execute given a requested action type, and will facilitate components so that all the plugins can receive all the information they need. Kind of sounds kind of too good to be true, to be honest. And yet that's what it says. So it is a bunch of header files and quite a few libraries. Things like barcode plugin, Bluetooth plugin, email plugin, imager plugin, you know, IMGUR, that one. KDE Connect plugin, KDE Connect SMS plugin, Pastebin plugin, Fabricator plugin, Save As plugin, Telegram plugin, Twitter plugin, and more. Though I didn't even list all of them. So that's a lot of plugins. It's a lot of libraries. And I mean, it sounds to me like it is, it must be what it says it is. I mean, it's a framework to make sure that services can be integrated into the Plasma desktop, but not really, it sounds like these are, it's almost like a messaging service or a, well, yeah, like a messenger. What are they called? Like RabbitMQ and things like that. You know, it's like a message stream. It gets the signal that you want it to get, and then it sorts out what it needs to forward, what actually needs to know about that signal. So it's kind of it's almost like an ingest, like a, you know, a load balancer, an ingest engine, whatever they're called. So yeah, you've got signals, something needs to deal with them, but we don't want to implement like the thing to deal with it. We just want to implement a listener to receive that signal and then make sure that it goes to the place that needs to get that signal. That's what it sounds to me like without me really getting into it any more than I just have, because that's about as much time as I want to dedicate to that. Sounds interesting. Sounds good. Sounds great. It kind of makes you wonder how hard or how easy it is to implement this. Because, I mean, it almost sounds as simple as, like, UDev or something. You know? I mean, it's kind of not that big of a deal as long as you know what to listen for. This, by the way, sort of brings to mind this and that Pulse Audio plugin, actually. This brings to mind what one of those maybe undersold things, or the things, one of the many things I take for granted within sort of the KDE space and just open source in general, I guess. But I mean, I guess specifically in KDE, is that Qt underpinning. The Qt framework, I'm sure I've probably said this before, but I mean, the Qt framework, if KDE didn't exist, and that would be a bad thing, I want KDE to continue to exist, but if it didn't exist, Qt would be really, I mean, it's still an important thing. Like, it's a vital component, I think, of open source GUI development. Qt is just such a powerful framework, and I don't know that you can really appreciate it without sort of experiencing it from the development side. And even then, it's hard to appreciate sometimes because it's hard. It's not easy. As I've said many times before, programming is not easy. It is a difficult thing to wrap your head around. And then once you've got your head mostly wrapped around it, it's still hard to implement. There's just a bunch of moving parts, lots of components that you have to stick together. But Qt, really, for everything that it is, it's this big package of functioning code parts that you can smash them together, and then you can compile them and you can put them on all kinds of systems. I mean, as we saw with that Pulse Audio thing, or at least hinting towards it, there's a plugin in Qt that ensures that you've got sound, it's going to interface with the primary targets on all of the platforms that it supports. And it supports them all. I mean, the cross-platformedness of Qt is no joke. Like, it is a serious, real thing. And it is not a hack. It is something that exists. And it's something that's, at least still, it's pretty integral into the framework. Like, they're very serious about it, and it comes through when you're using it, because it is just as easy as it can be to just send out your application on a bunch of computers. Qt gets really, really close to making it as easy as it possibly could be. In my humble opinion, Java is even easier and more of a guarantee. I highly recommend it, but Qt, really, really good, really, really nice. And then you got KDE on top of that. So the foundation is so, so important, and that is Qt. And it's important to kind of remember that. And the reason I'm thinking about that is just because of that ability of Qt to just abstract stuff. You know, there's so much going on in a computer. There's so much input, output, so many different possibilities. Qt just makes it as easy as it can be to not have to worry about that. You'd be amazed at how many SDKs and how many components you need to obtain to talk to a closed, non-open source operating system. Whereas with Qt, it's got most of that figured out for you. Like, the load Qt takes off of your shoulders just to get started on a computer, developing on a computer, is huge. Just alone, that much is just, it's huge. I mean, on Linux, we take it for granted because it's like, yeah, Qt, whatever. It interfaces with my computer. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's what development toolkits on Linux do. On other platforms, it's not like that. You have to jump through hoops to be able to develop for that platform. Qt makes it so simple compared to, for instance, going down the official path of, you know, like becoming a developer for that platform, blah, blah, blah. Don't bother. Just use Qt or Java, like I say. But yeah, Qt and then KDE on top of it, that dedication to taking care of stuff for the programmer, I really, really feel strongly, not authoritatively, but strongly, that's the direction programming really needs to go in, is where at least on some level, there's a level for people to be able to program and customize their environment and program their computer and make their computer work in the way that they want it to work. That needs to be something people can do. And if you have to worry about which audio library you're interfacing with to play your little music, then that's too much. Abstract that away from me. I don't care. Just make it play the sound. All I want is to design my little widget with a play button on it. And that's the kind of thing that Qt and KDE really, really make more possible than, you know, other options. And it comes through in things like the Pulse Audio plugin or the Pulse Audio library and the Purpose library, where you don't have to worry about those things anymore because these frameworks have figured that out for you, and you're just left with sort of the fun bits, the fun parts. Super important, and I think ingrained in the culture of this side of Linux development, and I just love it. That's the P section of the KDE, so I'll just queue up the Q section for next episode. Thanks for listening.